Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the key components of a happy, vibrant, lengthy life? As long as we are filling our calendars with workouts, healthcare appointments, and the extra time it takes to prepare and eat wholesome, nutritious meals, my guest today would suggest we also work in plenty of FaceTime, the old-fashioned kind, not the stuff you do with an iPhone, FaceTime with friends, family, and neighbors. Because for all the complications that come with hanging around other people, the bonds we form with them may literally be powerful enough to extend our lives. Susan Pinker is a developmental psychologist, columnist, and broadcaster. Her new book is called The Village Effect: How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. Susan, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
We've all heard that it takes a village to raise a child. It turns out we all need the village for our entire lives.
Yes, that's right. I think that we're under the impression that all social contact is created equal, but that's not quite true.
And regular time with friends could add years and years to our lives.
Yes, it's kind of an old-fashioned virtue, but what's completely new is that now we have evidence that such regular social contact with people in the flesh creates a whole biological cascade of events. And that connection has an impact on our health and our happiness and even how long we keep our memories.
So are we sure that, I mean, can we really separate this out and say that it's the social contact that keeps us healthy and cognitively active? Or could it be the other way around, that people who are fortunate enough to have physiological and mental health are able to keep up with friends longer?
That's a really great question, because it's very hard to tease those two apart. And the only way we can really answer that is by manipulating social contact. And we can't do that very easily with people. We can't sort of isolate, you know, matched groups of people versus unmatched groups, you know, versus people who are living in groups. You know, that's not ethical to do. But we can do it with animals. And we know that, for example, experiments where rats who are mammals, social mammals like us, are raised isolated, alone in cages, they develop 84 times as many cancerous tumors, breast tumors in particular, than rats who live in cages with other rats. So when you manipulate how much social contact social animals get, you can find out that there are some very serious downstream effects of isolation.
So, Susan, what are some of the ways that social contact appears to affect human biology?
Well, when you connect face-to-face with somebody, there's a whole bunch of hormones that get released, and the effect of these hormones is that they damp down stress in the here and now, and they can act as homegrown painkillers. And so, of course, these things on their own are quite important, but in the long term, they also enhance immunity and physical resilience, which is a bit counterproductive, because you'd think that if you go out in the world and you meet people and shake hands and give them high fives and so on, you would, you know, catch more colds and get sick more often, but it's the opposite.
I thought it was fascinating that our behaviors, healthy and sometimes unhealthy, can also be contagious among peers.
Yeah, that was so fascinating to me, because we're not really aware of what's going on when we connect with people. In other words, you know, there's a big difference, for example, when you have lunch with somebody and you're discussing maybe a difficult business problem or a prickly human issue that you have to solve in your family. There's a huge difference between doing that in person versus doing it through text or email or even Skype.
Okay, so many of us who are busy and we have different technologies and we can connect in these ways, we assume that if we can't get there in person, they're at least a good substitute. There was an interesting study that you quote in the book regarding teenage girls who had been stressed out and how they communicated or were able to communicate with their moms.
Yeah, that was another really interesting experimental study, because what they did is they actually induced stress in these girls. And the way that they did it was they had them stand in front of an audience and had to solve math problems within a time limit. I mean, that would stress most of us out, but especially teenage girls who are quite sensitive about how they appear to others.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did is they divided these girls into four groups, four equal groups. The first group got a visit from mom after the stressful kind of exam experience. The next group got a phone call from mom after that experience. Then there was a third group that got a reassuring text from mom, and the fourth group was a control, and they got nothing at all. And what happened was they saw kind of a gradual decrease in cortisol, meaning the amount of hormone that registers how much stress we're experiencing in the here and now. It's kind of a biological marker of stress. And they got these girls to spit in a cup, and they measured their cortisol, and they found out that the girls who had real contact from their mothers, face-to-face contact, their cortisol levels decreased the most. Then came the girls who had a phone call where they could hear their mother's voice and could chat with their mom and be reassured by hearing what she had to say. But interestingly, the next two groups, meaning the texting group and the control group, were equal. There was no decrease in cortisol or that measure of stress. So those of us who are parents who might be sending texts, you know, to our kids throughout the day that say things like, "I, you know, I'm with you, Mom. Yeah, I'm with you all the way," and or, you know, "I know you can really ace this test," or, you know, "Don't worry," et cetera, et cetera. It's having no impact at all.
It's good to know they still need us, even if they don't think so.
I know. They do need us, and I think that that's a really interesting point, which is, of course, with for teenagers, their peer group is really front and center. But parents are not irrelevant, and it's really important for parents to be able to check in with their teenagers in person. And the way we know that is because the evidence about family meals and their effect on teenage girls in particular is incredibly powerful. I mean, I'm sure you remember the chapter on food in which I describe how the frequency of family meals that kids have during the week is an incredibly strong predictor of whether or not they'll drop out of school or whether they'll become pregnant as teenagers or whether there'll be problems with eating disorders, substance abuse. It was almost uncanny how much that, I guess, face-to-face contact, albeit over food, was a cipher for so many, I guess, of positive outcomes.
And again, we're left with the question of whether families that are really well-functioning are the ones that are able to get it together and have dinner many times a week, or if there's something that is sort of magical about these meals that causes these good outcomes.
I think it's both. I think you're quite right that a family that functions well and is not in a huge amount of conflict is going to find it easier to sit down and eat together. I mean, it's not fun to, you know, spend FaceTime with people with whom you're having terrible conflicts. So I think that I would agree with you that there's kind of an interweaving of those two factors. But I think there's also the issue of when we know what people do that promotes success. So, for example, we know that people who exercise regularly are healthier and live longer. Okay, so even those of us who are not naturally athletic, we can adopt those habits. Or, you know, when we know that, for example, certain, lifestyles, whether it might be healthy eating or living in certain neighborhoods, promote certain positive outcomes, we can kind of shift our behavior in that direction consciously as if we're aping what works for other people.
It's so interesting to think, going back to this question of meals, because historically, people simply ate together. That was something that you did. It was a lot of work to get it together, and then everybody sat down at the same time. Now our society makes it so easy for people to, you know, get food from an anonymous person through a window and drive along the freeway in their car and nibble on things. That would clearly seem to not have the same benefits as talking with people that you care about, at least enough to share food with them.
Yeah, and I think it's a question of the structures that we used to take for granted, and I think family meals or communal meals is just one of those features, are gradually falling away. And so, you know, one of them is that it's we're very busy, so we can drive up to a window and get our food and eat it in the car. The other is that we are in our cars much more often, so we're a very mobile society, and that means that we're not actually in the same place as the people who are important to us at mealtime and at other critical times. So there's this huge downstream effect of existential loneliness. It's not just that we're not eating together, we're not really talking to each other as often as we used to. We're not talking to our neighbors as much as we used to. And our physical environment has changed. So it's not as if we are kind of walking down the block and either picking up the newspaper or picking up our weekly groceries the way we used to do. I mean, I think the fault is not really, I would say, our online behavior so much. I think they're just one piece of the puzzle.
That's just one more distraction from what used to be inevitable social encounters.
Yeah, it used to be that we would cross paths with people, whether we liked it or not. And, of course, this could create friction, right? There were many people who didn't really like their neighbors, and it just happened to be the people that they were living next to. But somehow we managed to be civil, and we managed to kind of look after people in our communities, even if they were different from us. And now a couple of things are happening. We value our independence so much, and we value, I guess, the ease and convenience of online contact so much that some of these kind of natural pauses within our day where we used to interact with other people have just disappeared.
We tend to take it for granted in this country, not that anybody's happy about this, but we assume it is fact, that women on average live a few years longer than men. It turns out there are places in the world where men do just as well as women.
Yeah. You know, this is where I started with the book, and it's partly the source of the title, which is, my last book was on sex differences, and one of the biggest, most immutable sex differences is the lifespan gap between men and women. So almost everywhere in the world, except places where women still, die regularly in childbirth, women typically live 5 to 7 years longer than men on average. And, of course, I don't mean every woman lives that much longer than every man, but as a group. And the only place where this isn't the case is an isolated mountainous area of Sardinia. And when I learned about this, I thought, I have to go there and find out what's going on. And so I traveled there with my daughter, in fact, to investigate this, to meet with the scientists who were exploring the phenomenon, and to actually interview the centenarians themselves. And it was a really, I would say, illuminating experience to find out what their lives are like day to day. They're so different than the way we age in North America.
Starting with the fact that elderly people essentially never live alone.
They not only never live alone, they're almost never left alone. Hmm. So one of the kind of unusual, even peculiar aspects of this research trip was it was very hard to interview any of these centenarians without them being interrupted by neighbors, nieces and nephews, children, grandchildren, etc. They were sort of considered communal property, but very highly respected, if not treasured. And I think they were partially just naturally never left alone. There was always somebody to have conversation. But there was also the feeling of we have to protect them from this stranger who has come into our community to ask our elders these questions. And we need to make sure that, my parent or grandparent is safe and comfortable and not ill at ease.
Let me jump in here. My guest is Susan Pinker. Her new book is The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is developmental psychologist Susan Pinker. Her new book is called The Village Effect: How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Susan, is there something special about the size of a village such as you might find in Sardinia?
Yes. I think that we have a limit, I think, a neural limit to how many people that we can really keep in our real face-to-face network. And in a Sardinian village, it's certainly not the size of your average, say, Facebook community of hundreds and hundreds. People gather in kind of small networks of maybe 100 to 250 people. And that's what we call Dunbar's number. There's a psychologist in the UK who has proposed that because it's so common that the size of our social networks throughout history has hovered around 150, that this is really the maximum that our brains can handle in terms of the number of contacts. And what's really interesting about that 150 is that it's not only, you know, the size of English villages and the size of platoons in the armed forces and the size of the average Christmas card list. It's also the size of businesses that manage to function well without hierarchical structures. Mm. So there's something about the human brain that kind of fixes on a kind of limit to contact, the number of contacts we can handle. And if you don't keep up the face-to-face contact with those in that circle, they start to decay in as little as 18 months. And so then your slot becomes filled with someone else.
So you know the person's still out there. You may hear from them occasionally. But if you're not in regular communication, it's like a use it or lose it for friendships.
That's a great way to put it, actually, because, you know, you have, I guess, a window of between about 18 months to about 4 or 5 years before, essentially, you get replaced. And what I find, you know, interesting about that is that as people age in our society, often our contacts fall away naturally. I mean, people get sick and die. Some of them move away. Children, you know, especially in our society, are quite mobile and don't necessarily live near their parents, whereas in Sardinia, they tend to. And then what happens with those holes? And one of the things I learned from researching this book is that you have to fill that gap with somebody else. In other words, you have to, you know, once those kind of holes in your social network are created either by lack of contact or by distance, you really have to plant somebody else in that gap.
So what does all this need for social interaction, does it suggest anything about the potential downsides of this great American dream, the early retirement?
Well, you know, I haven't researched early retirement per se, but there is a relationship between early retirement and male mortality, strangely enough. In that, you know, when people who are very involved in their work withdraw from the workplace, they lose that social contact that they were used to. And if they haven't groomed a whole kind of network of people that they would play cards with or, you know, play sports with or go out to dinner with or have book clubs with, essentially, they're suddenly alone. And for men especially, that's very dangerous.
And in terms of technology, many people are very excited or had been initially about the potential for things like digital learning, meaning, you know, you put somebody in front of a computer and they take a class that way. A lot of these massive open online courses turn out not to have been very successful at all. Can you talk about what you learned about that?
Yes, I think at pretty much all levels, these massive online courses or MOOCs are intended for college students or adults, but even at younger levels, you know, when children are in school, there's a huge movement to put, you know, tablets and laptops in kids' hands in the classroom, and it's very expensive. And there's absolutely no evidence that it's any better than a trained teacher. I think that it can even be harmful for some groups of kids who are particularly vulnerable, who really, really need that face-to-face contact to learn. So I think we're under the illusion that because these devices are so powerful that they can do everything. What they're really good at is finding information quickly. We all know that. And they're great for logistics. But what they're not good at is deepening human connections. And human beings are social creatures, and we learn in social environments. We learn best in social environments. So that's one of the reasons why MOOCs really don't work that well, except for the small fraction of highly independent, highly motivated learners. And that's not the group that they're really created for.
Reading your book, I thought back to a show that we did years ago on education, and someone said, children learn to love the subjects taught by the teachers they connect with the most intensively.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because that was certainly the case with my own children, who, if they liked a teacher, they would do anything, and if they disliked that teacher, they would, like, it was like you turned off the switch.
Right.
The light went out. And, you know, we don't really know exactly why this kind of digital revolution in the classroom is not having the expected effects or the hoped-for effects. But I would hypothesize that being social creatures, and especially in language-related type areas, so or empathy-related like areas, such as reading literature, that interacting with a machine just doesn't cut it. Plus, you know, even though there are, say, chat rooms that are built in to many of these online courses, essentially you don't get the attention of the teacher. You may be one of 5,000 learners. Or if you're in the classroom, it's not as if, as we used to do, you would raise your hand, learn to wait your turn, and then the teacher would call on you, and you would have to formulate a comprehensible type of question. Now, essentially, it's a much more anonymous type of communication. So I think all of these, like, bits accumulate to make it a less satisfying learning experience, not only for kids, but for adults.
We have an email here from Maria who says, there's been more use of Skype and video conferencing in behavioral medicines. I would love you to comment on the use of these techniques in psychotherapy, et cetera.
You know, that's an interesting question, because I was a clinical psychologist, and that was my first career. And just as I was making the transition to writing full-time, people who I saw in the clinic had started to email me. And it was quite an interesting blurring of the boundaries between what would happen in a clinical setting and what would happen, you know, outside. So, you know, that's not to say that either one is positive or negative, but suddenly patients felt that they had access to you 24/7. So that was interesting. My view on that is there are incredible benefits to offering services to people who are isolated or too sick to go out. So I think it's a great stopgap measure, I think, digital-type counseling, for example, or Skype. But it's not as good as the face-to-face. So if that's the best that you can do, it's certainly better than nothing at all. But I think that if we were to design our health and mental health services in the way that they would be most effective, we wouldn't put the emphasis on digital connection.
How important is it? I mean, I think we can all imagine that it makes sense that we need to have, you know, our loved ones, our closest friends and family members around us. I was surprised to learn about how important it is to also have people in your life that you can just kind of give a friendly wave to or chat with in the elevator or just see occasionally, but not necessarily bond with deeply.
Yes, that is what I meant partially by the village. We have our inner layer of the people who are really close to us. And by the way, Chris, that inner layer is falling apart. I mean, we used to have more people in that inner intimate layer than we do now. But there's also kind of an outer layer of the kinds of people that we meet throughout the day, be they neighbors, be they retail people who we would meet regularly, be they colleagues that you see every day in the elevator when you walk down the corridor. And those people, or most importantly, the people who, the diverse people that might populate the groups that you belong to. So, for example, if you go to church and you see people every Sunday in church, those fellow churchgoers, or, and it doesn't have to be a religious group, but I'm just using that as an example, form part of your village, and they're an extremely important piece of the puzzle of why, say, for example, religious people tend to have better health and better mental health than people who don't practice any religion. You know, my view is that their village is built in, but you don't really need, for example, if you are a non-believer, you don't really need to go to church to get that. You can find it elsewhere.
So we all know people, Susan, who have never met a stranger. They'll chat up friends. They'll chat up people that they meet on a bus stop. They just live for human interaction. There are others who are less comfortable with that, who seem to need more alone time, less human interaction. Do they somehow need the village effect less, or are they missing out? Are introverts missing out on the benefits of the village effect?
I think that social contact is like a lot of, or even all of our other biological appetites, say like food, drink, sleep, sex, all of these appetites, and social contact is just one, really vary between person to person in terms of how much each person needs to be happy and healthy. So introverts do need social contact. They do need that village effect just as much as everyone else does. But they just need to be able to control it so that they're not overwhelmed by it. So it's like if you have, you know, a small appetite, you don't want to be forced to eat, you know, three big meals a day when that's not what you want. And similarly, introverts should not be forced, for example, to have roommates where they have to interact 24/7. So I give, in the book, in The Village Effect, I give the example of how one of the introverts I know prefers going to potluck, larger parties, where he can slip away when he feels like, okay, that's enough. And he's not as crazy about going to sit-down dinner parties or social events where if suddenly he says, I have to get up and go, it's going to be a social gaffe. So to answer your question, introverts need it as much as everyone. And they just have to, all of us have to decide, how much do we need to be, to function well, to kind of grease the wheels of our day and to be resilient to what will hit us.
Another thing that a circle of friends and neighbors can do is really help us during and after traumatic effects. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about outcomes for people who have friends they can lean on in times of crisis as compared with those who really feel like they have to go it alone?
More and more people are going it alone, and It's really an interesting paradox because right now we're more connected than we ever were in terms of our digital connections, but people have never really been lonelier. And it's extremely critical for our health, especially in times of crisis, to have people we can lean on. A lot of this research comes from two areas. One is when we have environmental disasters, such as earthquakes or floods. What we know about who survives is that the people who have a village, people, a large group of people they can depend on who are going to go and check up on them, who can lend them money or bring them food if necessary, those people are more likely to make it than people who are more solitary. That's one piece of evidence. And the other piece of evidence is something called the widowhood effect. We talked a little bit earlier about the lifespan gap between men and women. And one of the factors in that lifespan gap is that men tend to have smaller social networks than women do. So they're less likely than women to groom their social contacts assiduously over their lifespan. So what happens is that many men really have one person they can depend on, and that's their wife or their spouse or partner of the time. And so if something terrible happens to that man, to the woman, I'm sorry, and he loses her, then he's alone. And this creates what's called the widowhood effect, which means that essentially when a wife dies, a husband is in incredible danger of dying himself within 6 months to a year right afterwards. This is not the case for women. And my view is because they have much more social buttressing. It's not that they're less broken up and less lonely when their spouses die, but they have friends they can talk to. And one of the surprising facts I learned when researching the book was that older people do much better in communities of other people like themselves. This completely threw me for a loop.
What did you expect to find?
Well, I had expected to find what I call the Jane Jacobs effect, that we're all healthier in diverse communities where you're all living together in a kind of happy conglomeration of, you know, babies, school-aged children, teenagers, adults, and older folks all living happily together. But what the research is telling us is that especially for older folks, they do much better, especially when hard knocks hit them, when there are other people nearby who know what it's like. Mm. So when I was in Sardinia, for example, I visited a female centenarian who was there with her neighbors. So Teresa, who was a centenarian, was 100 years old. Her neighbor was 80 years old, and they had both lost their spouses. So they weren't going it alone. They had each other, and they had their kids, and they had other neighbors. But the fact that there were a lot of people like themselves in that community meant that they didn't feel that they were so unusual or that they were socially isolated.
We're speaking with developmental psychologist, columnist, and broadcaster Susan Pinker. Her new book is called The Village Effect: How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or send me a tweet. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with developmental psychologist Susan Pinker, author of the new book, The Village Effect: How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Susan, in some ways, a lot of what you write about in this book, as I read it, it felt like, oh, of course, I've known that all along. It makes sort of intuitive sense in many cases. But clearly, it's not intuitive enough to us that we are making sure that we have in our lives enough of this face-to-face contact.
Yeah, it's a weird kind of combination of, yes, everybody knows that we should get together with friends, and the combination of surprising statistics or the new evidence that's underlying it. And I was surprised myself. For example, the Holt-Lundstad study, where they looked at a huge group of people, 39,000 people, and they tracked every aspect of their lives. So they, you know, how obese they were and how much exercise they got, how much did they drink, how much did they smoke, how much pollution was in their area, etc. And then they followed them into the future to see what best predicted mortality over the next 7 years. So in other words, looking at this huge group now and then seeing, once they measured everything, what was the, you know, the best kind of soothsayer about who would still be alive. And more than anything else, having an integrated social life predicted survival. So all the things that we've put a huge amount of stock in, it's not that they're not important. You know, it's important to quit smoking if you're a heavy smoker, or to reduce your drinking if that's problematic. But it's even more important to have an integrated social life. And I didn't know that.
I don't know the extent to which this is different in Canada, but in the United States, we have this culture of rugged individualism, right, where we feel like we ought to be able to take care of ourselves, and to only a limited extent do we feel obligated to care for people who are not members of our immediate family or social circle. And I wonder if that causes, you know, North American society to be more susceptible to some of the effects of isolation than in other parts of the world.
I think you're onto something there. You know, George Burns once quipped that, you know, happiness is having a large, loving, caring, close-knit family living in another city. And I think this is part of the American idea. We want to say that we have these close bonds, but a lot of us don't want to put the hard work into keeping them alive. And you're right, we are a very independent society. We prize independence much more than we prize mutual support. And one of the most interesting questions I've had since the book came out a few days ago was, you know, people have actually said to me, well, how do I build a village then? Hmm. Like, how do I talk to my neighbors? And I found this a shocking question, because we've lost the ability to talk to people face-to-face. I mean, most of us now know that, you know, what used to be normal and natural, meaning people, neighbors would drop in each other and hang out on each other's porches and so on, that fell away long ago. But then it became that the tradition that if you wanted to get together with somebody, you would pick up the phone and call and say, hey, what are you doing on Friday night? Do you want to get together and watch the game and have pizza or whatever it is that you like to do? Now, if you want to make a phone call, you have to make an appointment, like via email or text, saying, you know, can I call you at 2 p.m.? And even teenagers are doing this. They consider it rude to just pick up the phone and call their buddies. So I would agree that we are isolating ourselves, and it's not for the good.
It occurred to me also reading this book that, you know, I live in a neighborhood where, you know, people meet each other like walking the dog or taking a stroll through the neighborhood. But if there is neighborhood news, we've got a website for that. So there's no knocking on, you know, nine doors to spread the word about something. You are expected to go to the website.
Yeah, and I think actually that's great, because websites are great for spreading news. I think that what it's missing is the extra kind of stuff that might get added to what happens when you spread the news face-to-face. And that you can do while you're walking your dog, or, you know, while you're strolling down the street after dinner. So I think websites and the Internet in general are perfectly suited to spreading information, and Facebook is too. I think what it isn't suited for is deepening that human connection. So, for example, just before we started chatting on this program, I met somebody in my neighborhood whose mother had died in July, and I hadn't had a chance to connect. Now, email would have been totally unsuited for the conversation that we had, which was a conversation about existential loneliness after you lose somebody who's extremely important to you. Hmm. So I would say that, you know, who's moving in and who's moving out, or, who just got a new puppy, and is there going to be a communal supper at some time soon? There's nothing wrong with the web for that. But if somebody's child is sick, or a parent has died, or something has happened, either good or bad, that really needs a more nuanced type of connection, and then really there's nothing beats the face-to-face for establishing those bonds.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Ed in Dallas. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good, good. I just wanted to call and comment that I've had some very similar experiences. Back a few years ago, I purchased a place in Belize in Central America and spent quite a bit of time there. And since doing that, the friendships that we've developed, and a lot of it's because you can't, you know, the technology is not widely available. You don't always have cell service. You definitely don't always have internet service. So people keep in touch face to face, and it makes for great relationships and really you feel more comfortable and safe and just generally happy there, I think, than I do here in Dallas in a city of millions of people, but where I don't really get to see any close friends on a real regular basis because we're always so busy.
What do you think, Susan? Thanks so much for your call, Ed.
Yeah, I think Ed raises a really important point about city living. And that's that you don't actually, even though it's wonderful to be in a place like Belize where these things happen naturally, or Sardinia where it's just part of the culture, but you actually can create that village effect right where you live, even in Dallas. I mean, I think it takes much more effort. But I think you can sort of isolate what it is that you really liked about that community in Belize and see if you can replicate it in your own community.
It is interesting that we have built, some newer areas are built so that you drive straight into your garage or you even go through an alley. And so there's not a lot of walking around in the front yard. We did all this because we wanted privacy, maybe after our parents and grandparents lived in like really densely populated urban areas. And now we do all this to separate ourselves. And then we jump online hoping to recreate what we've lost.
Exactly. So I think we've gone too far because we've never been lonelier than now. We used to, even 30 years ago, we had an average of about 3 confidants or people we could depend on. Now we have less than 2, and many people just have 1, meaning that one person in your life, your spouse or your partner. And this has taken a huge toll on our health and our happiness and our longevity, I think. With medical advances, we are living longer, but I think we could live even longer, happier lives if we had this village around us.
Do you think there's a benefit to the fact that, many children are sort of launching a little bit later than they did when you and I were teenagers, that we're keeping them around longer and maybe staying closer to our kids than previous generations?
I think that's a wonderful thing. Actually, I think, I can't really comment on the factors involved with, young adults taking a little longer to launch their careers. But I will say, as a parent of 3 young adults, that it's wonderful to have them close by and that it really does, they are an important part of one's village. So I had an interesting story to tell about a translator I worked with on the Sardinian chapter, who was a neurologist from that area and from Sardinia, but who was living in Montreal, my home city, doing a neurology residency. And she was very disturbed by the fact that she was so far away from her parents. This is a woman in her mid-30s, highly educated, highly mobile. And when she got a job offer, it threw her into, I would say, an existential crisis that would be unusual for people in their mid-30s in the United States, mm-hmm. because she felt it was her, not only her obligation, but she wanted to be near her parents as they aged. So that was a very interesting lesson to me. She felt like she was missing something. She told me she spoke to her mother every day, and that her mother knew exactly from the tone of her voice if her day was going well or if it was going badly. So I think you've asked a very interesting question about kind of the flip side of everybody's moaning and groaning about 20-something-year-olds taking a little bit longer to get started. It may not be so bad.
If people look around and say, okay, I'm one of those people that is down to 1.8 confidants and I don't have a lot of, meaningful, regular social interaction, what do we do to sort of climb back into those habits when we may have lost them, years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a process. Just as if you want to lose 30 pounds, you can't just do it overnight. And when we were talking a little bit before about the benefits of belonging to a group such as a religious congregation, I think that's a really good place to start, because even if you're not comfortable reaching out to other people, when you're in those settings, they reach out to you. So an example from my own life is that, I used to exercise by myself, But then as my work became more solitary, I felt a need for much more social contact, the kind that I got in my formerly got in my office situation. I thought, how am I going to get that? I mean, I love talking to my neighbors and so on, but it's just not enough. So instead of swimming laps all by myself at the Y, I joined a swim team. And 3 times a week, I was literally close to about, 50 women, not only in the pool, but in the locker room. And, you know, we talked about movies and books and our kids and you know, the stresses in our lives while we were getting ready to go swimming and afterwards. And at that point, I had met a whole bunch of new people, and it could kind of got me through the quiet parts of my day. And I think that those types of activities, everybody has to find one that's right for them. But if they find themselves in a group doing an activity they enjoy, then I think those things will happen naturally, and their close friends will start to develop.
It's great because you have to be doing it anyway, so you might as well sort of get double the benefit.
Exactly. And people who are shyer and more introverted will find that the more gregarious types will reach out to them.
I just want to touch on one other thing that you say in the book, and that is that teacher, parent, and peer interaction need to be really a major priority for us when thinking about what's best for young children.
You know, that's one of the bits of information that I wondered, isn't this just obvious to everyone? But I guess it's not, because we've fallen in love with the, I guess, incredible optimism and attraction of our devices. And it's extremely important, especially for young children, babies and toddlers in particular, but even as kids grow, to make sure that they have that face-to-face contact. And, you know, as our lives get more streamlined, as people work longer hours, as there are more financial stresses, I think that's one of our kind of homegrown virtues that's starting to fade a little bit, and we've forgotten how important it is. And so in the book, you know, in the middle 3 chapters, I move through all of child development, showing just how critical it is, not only for kids learning, but for their happiness, to have that face-to-face contact with their friends, with their parents, with their extended families, and for parents and teachers to put limits on how much time they spend in front of a screen. Right now, kids, young kids, meaning preschool kids, are spending between 3 and 4 hours a day in front of a screen, and school-age kids are spending 7 to 8 hours a day in front of a screen. This is more than they spend on any other activity, including sleeping.
I hate to jump in with that disturbing statistic, but we are out of time. Susan Pinker's new book is The Village Effect: How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. Susan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
And thank you, Chris, for inviting me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We had help on the phones today from Christina Ulsh. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.